This week on The Score, what's going on in Venezuela? How did Ronald Reagan win the Cold War against the Soviet Union? Can local governments in Virginia tax freelance writers? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Over the past couple of weeks, The Score has been in reruns, recycling some older interviews about history and biography. This week, we are back with new interviews about current affairs, but also a couple of conversations drawn from the archives. Coming up first is a repeat guest. Daniel DiMartino is an economics student at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He and his family are also refugees from Venezuela, where an oppressive government has driven millions of people out of the country. Daniel was a guest on The Score late last year. I met him earlier this month in Washington to talk about what has been happening in Venezuela and how the U.S. government has responded. Here's Daniel DiMartino. So Daniel, when we last spoke, you were telling us about your own family's experience. Why don't you go over that a little bit so we know where you're coming from, quite literally.
Yeah, so I was born in 1999. That's the same year Hugo Chavez became the president of Venezuela. He was elected the year before. And ever since I was born, the country just went worse and worse. More shortages, I experienced blackouts, water shortages, until my family, after going from earning thousands of dollars a month to earning just $2 per day, they decided, you know, to leave. And I also decided to come to the United States thanks to my university. And I'm now living in Spain, my parents and grandparents, and I'm living here in the U.S.
And this week, there's big news about Venezuela. The U.S. Department of State issued sanctions on the Venezuelan government and puts Venezuela on the same level as North Korea or Cuba, basically saying nobody in the United States can trade with Venezuela at all or with anybody who's involved in the government. What do you think of that?
Well, first, it is important to note that the embargo, quote-unquote, is just a ban on trading with the Venezuelan regime. Venezuelans can still send remittances, people can buy and sell food, they can cross the border. Private companies that are not involved with the regime can trade internationally. So I think that this embargo is great news for Venezuelans because it means that no U.S. person and no foreign person that does anything with a U.S. person either will be able to trade with the Venezuelan government and allow them to profit. And it's not even a profit, it's just to steal from the Venezuelan people. I think that it's always great to stop thieves.
Yeah, and what explains the resilience of the Maduro regime? The country has lost a quarter of its population, something like that. The economy is in collapse. How does Maduro stay in power?
Well, Maduro stays in power because, unfortunately, what gives real power is the guns. And he has the military. He has them either bribed through drug dealing. They control the international drug trafficking to the United States, cocaine especially, that comes from Colombia and then is exported to the U.S. And they profit from that, the leaders of the military as well as the lower levels. So even then, if there's dissent within the military, they have the Cuban intelligence that helps them quash any dissent that there is and jail them. So That's the way that Maduro keeps power. It doesn't matter if he has 90% of the population against him, he has the guns to attack them.
Now, you mentioned that Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999. He ran for office on a certain platform and said what he would do. As a student of economics, you would have been able to predict that his policies would be failures.
how long did it take for the economy of Venezuela to collapse under the weight of its socialist system?
I would say it was a gradual process. It started in the early 2000s, around 2001, when Chavez started nationalizing land. And that's when everybody who had a basic knowledge of economics could say, with the nationalization of land, we're just going to see food production collapse. And that's exactly what happened. Food production collapsed. I could see in the road between Maracay and Caracas, two cities, how there was a huge land, basically, that was nationalized, and the government created some greenhouses and put a huge sign saying, made in socialism. Those greenhouses were empty. After 10 years, the thing is still empty. The sign is just breaking apart, and it is the exact definition of what socialism is. And they just put it in a huge sign, and that's what happened. So I would say it took about 10 years to see huge shortages and consequences. It started in 2010, around that time when I was still a child, but I could remember it.
You could ask the question, why would they build greenhouses in a tropical country?
I agree, yes. That's the problem with central planning everywhere, that the government just does not have the information or the knowledge required to do the activities of private businesses, because only the businessman, only the owner that owns and lives and works there is capable of actually having the incentive to produce, because if he's going to profit, then he's going to do it. And if it's not profitable, then he won't. The government just will do anything to hire a bunch of people, give them a job and get the votes, not what's necessary for the economy.
Now, obviously, some people are benefiting from the collapse of Venezuela's economy, the corrupt government officials and others. But how much popular support does the regime have? How long can it last?
Well, polls say that they have still about 10% of the population, which is a very small minority, but it's still sizable.
That's actually more people than say they have confidence in the U.S. Congress.
Well, yeah. So 10% of the population still supports Maduro, and that's probably part of the education system, how they have taken all the institutions, the media. They have nationalized most media channels, and the media channels that are still private are controlled by regime friends. So they have brainwashed 10% of the population. It's hard to take that back. But 90% of the population is opposed to Maduro. With 90% of the population, any country should be able to change its government. We just don't have free elections to be able to do so, and that's what we need. We need to take Maduro out, go through a transitional government to actually be able to organize free elections, because Maduro won't organize free elections ever. And then we need to elect our own future, and a future of free markets, hopefully.
And also, there are millions of Venezuelans who now live outside the country. I saw a headline yesterday that 24,000 babies have been born to Venezuelans who have escaped to Colombia. And there are a lot of Venezuelans like yourself in the United States who are here as guests of the United States. Can you explain what their status is and whether there's a danger that they'll have to be sent back?
Yeah, by 2017, there were about 400,000 Venezuelans in the United States, according to the U.S. Census. Right now, we're in 2019. It's probably over 500,000, given the huge exodus that's happened in the last 2 years, or perhaps even more. Most of these Venezuelans have actually become U.S. citizens through the legal process. But about half of them are, even though they're in legal status, they are in, you know, like student visas, work visas, or they're even in visitor's visas. Others are waiting for their asylums to be approved or not. Venezuela is the number one country that requests asylum in the U.S. for the last 6 years, more than China, more than any other country. So the danger is that many of these Venezuelans, including myself, our legal status will end up expiring, and then we'll have to go back to Venezuela. So I don't think it's right to send back about 200,000 people to a country, not only that has the highest murder rate in the region and one of the highest in the world, but also where people are starving because there's no way, no matter what's your level of education, to succeed without stealing or without trafficking drugs. Congress recently passed something, the House of Representatives recently passed the Venezuela TPS Act of 2019. And this act would allow Venezuelans who are here in the United States to stay and work for a limited period of time, subject to renewal, like other nations have it. and it will protect them from deportation. And I think that the president, in fact, the president does not have to wait for Congress to do this. President Trump should really designate Venezuela as a TPS country.
Now, of course, this would be an internal contradiction in the Trump administration's policy. On the one hand, they're trying to depose the Venezuelan regime. On the other hand, they oppose immigrants. Do you think that there could be any reconciliation there?
I do. I think that while the Trump administration has tried to eliminate TPS for other countries, Venezuela is a country that meets perfectly the legal definition for TPS. Many of the countries that the TPS is trying to be terminated are not going anymore through civil wars or through incredible political conflicts. Mm-hmm. They are in bad states, and I'm not saying their program should be terminated, but Venezuela is a country that truly meets the definition. Additionally, granting TPS to Venezuelans will be a huge benefit for the administration, not only politically, but also because if President Trump is serious about fighting socialism at home, what best way to show that than by accepting the victims of socialist regimes such as Venezuela's, the same way we do with Cuba, the same way the United States did with former USSR citizens that have come to America, they have integrated here, and they have shared their stories so that we cannot ever repeat again the mistakes of socialism.
How long do you think it will take for Venezuela to recover once there are free elections? It was once one of the richest countries in the Western Hemisphere. How long will it take to get back to that status?
I think that the famine that is going on and the refugee crisis will stop in a matter of a few months. Whether it will become the richest country in a few months, I don't think so. But I think that within a few years, our country would rapidly recover if we just eliminated the government controls and privatized the industries that were taken by the government. It's just natural. When a country has nothing, it grows very fast. Mm-hmm. And in a country with so much oil like Venezuela, the growth that we would get from all the investment that would come, it would just flock to our country, and that's what we need. It would be a paradise for investment, and it would be great for the United States, it would be great for the region, and it would be great for Venezuelans.
Not to mention the tourism.
True tourism. We have amazing islands. You know, we have the archipelago of Los Roques. We have Margarita. We have many other places that have huge potential for tourism.
Well, Daniel DiMartino, thank you for joining us again on The Score from Bering Drift. It's a pleasure to meet you in person. Last time we spoke by telephone, it's really nice to see you here in Washington, D.C. Good luck in all your studies.
Thank you, Rick. Likewise.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
In the first of our conversations from the archives, I talked to Grove City College historian Paul Kangor about two of his books about the last decades of the Cold War. We met in 2011 at the Conservative Political Action Conference, where I asked him about two of his books, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan and the Fall of Communism, and Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century.
Let's talk first about, since it's just after Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday, let's talk about The Crusader. Tell me about that book, how you came to write it, and what it's about.
Sure. Well, it began when I realized that a lot of people in academia, and really generally, didn't understand that Ronald Reagan actually intended to undermine the Soviet Empire. I mean, they knew from his rhetoric and his speeches and the Westminster Address in June 1982, the Notre Dame speech in May 1981, the Evil Empire speech in March 1983. They knew he thought the Soviet communism was evil. They knew that he predicted it would end up on the ash heap of history and all that stuff. But they thought that might have been predictions. They thought that that might have been rhetoric. But what they didn't realize is that behind all of that was a very specific campaign on multiple fronts, probably about a dozen to maybe two dozen different things, where Reagan actually intended to peacefully undermine the USSR. And I collected all of those things in The Crusader, and I also backed them up by not just actions, but the actual formal NSDDs. Those are National Security Decision Directives that have been declassified. I mean, if academics are going to be scholars, like they call themselves, they need to read primary sources, like they tell their students to do. But they don't. They read each other, and they cite each other, and they don't learn anything. All this information has been declassified. You look at NSDD 32, NSDD 66, NSDD 75, and you see here a clear intent to roll back, undermine, and as one of the documents says, bring political pluralism. It actually uses that word, pluralism, to the Soviet Union. So what happened was intended, and there's a paper trail to prove it. And beyond the paper trail, all the people who were involved in this are either still alive or died in the last 10 years and have been or were available to be interviewed to speak about it. And I've interviewed all of those people. I mean, everybody that I could find. Bill Clark, Cap Weinberger, George Shultz, Richard V. Allen. And they will tell you this, that was the intention. So if scholars want to be scholars, they need to do some actual research. They need to do some actual scholarship. And they're not, and that's scandalous.
What's the origin of the title of the book?
The Crusader. As I was reading Soviet documents at Pravda, Izvestia, Moscow, there's a show called Studio 9, which was the main TV station, main TV show in Moscow, basically the Moscow version of 60 Minutes, right? Memoirs, all sorts of other things, Anatoly Dobrynin, Andrei Gromyko, they called Reagan the Crusader. They called Reagan the Crusader. And I thought, wow. And the Soviets understood better than American liberal academics that Reagan, beginning in the 1950s, had signed up for groups like General Lucius Clay's Crusade for Freedom, Dr. Fred Schwartz's anti-communist Christian Crusade. So Reagan had been using that word. He didn't mean it in a religious sense, although Reagan was religiously inspired to undermine this viciously atheistic empire. As Gorbachev said, the Soviets pursued a war on religion. But Reagan meant the word crusade in the sense of a crusade for freedom, a crusade to undermine.
From your research, do you know whether the Soviets at the time knew about all those NSDDs before the American people knew about them after they were declassified?
That's a very good question. They were classified at the time, but there was some leaking, and I think it might have been intentional leaks, to get out some of the NSDDs. In fact, I did an interview a few years ago. It's posted on our Center for Vision and Values website with Mark Zimmerman. And I believe it was NSDD 75, which was written by Richard Pipes, the Harvard Sovietologist who was at the National Security Council. And the information on that was leaked out by somebody intentionally, but not the entire thing. And when the Soviets heard that that was out, they were apoplectic. They wanted to find out what's in that document. They badly wanted to know what was in that document. Because the Soviets knew that Reagan had drawn crosshairs on their empire. They were in the crosshairs of the Crusader. How's that for a way to put it? So the Soviets, they were hungry to find out what specifically the Reagan administration was doing. And they knew, and they said later, here's the other thing, too. Is that all these people from the Soviet Union are available to be interviewed. And I quote all of them in the Crusader as well. But, you know, they knew that Reagan was coming at them from multiple angles. And I would tell young people in particular, if you run into a liberal professor who denies that Reagan had anything to do with the Soviet Union, that professor needs to know that the Soviets disagree with him, that the Poles disagree with him, that the people behind the Iron Curtain, the former Iron Curtain, disagree with him. That professor needs to know he is in a very tiny minority and doesn't have evidence for his assertions. In fact, maybe that's why they avoid the primary source documents. They're afraid that it will dispel a lot of their sacred cows about how Reagan allegedly had nothing to do with this.
Very good. Let's switch gears and talk about your new book, Dupes. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I was doing more archival research, and especially in the Soviet Comintern archives on CPUSA. The Soviet Comintern was the Soviet Communist International. CPUSA was Communist Party USA. And I got to the very first reel of microfiche, and it was obvious then and there that, one, just like all the anti-communists had said for the past 100 years, through the McCarthy period and everything else, there is a very close collusion between the American Communist Party and the Soviet Communist Party. In fact, the very first document you get in the microfiche are the comrades in Chicago in September 1919 sending a letter to the comrades in Moscow at the Comintern, saying basically, we did it. That document's in the book. We did it. We founded the Communist. Long live the Soviet Socialist Republic. You know, America will be communist soon. They're thrilled about this. And then the next thing I saw, which was really an eye-opener, was how they very carefully, cynically, shrewdly, in a very conniving way, targeted American liberals and progressives for manipulation. The liberals and progressives weren't communists, but they were also on the left. And so there was a very deliberate campaign that went on for a long, long time, and I would argue still even to some extent takes place today, where the communists would lie to the liberals and progressives. They wouldn't tell them that they were communists. And they very intentionally tried to mislead and manipulate them, and with tremendous success, especially among academics, Columbia University in particular, and also, sadly, among the religious left, the social justice religious left, who, as one veteran investigator of the American Communist Movement told me for this book, the religious left were the biggest suckers of them all, especially the mainline Protestant denominations.
The National Council of Churches.
Yes, they fell over and over and over again for the wolves in sheep's clothing.
So have you read Ernest Lefebvre's books, Amsterdam to Nairobi?
You know, I should have, and I have a couple of them. No, I haven't. Not like I should. But I haven't given up on this subject yet. I just got an email last week from a very liberal pastor in Connecticut who practically was screaming at me through the email. He wanted to know why Reagan didn't speak to the National Council of Churches. And I said, well, you know, it's a very far-left group, and between the National Council of Churches and its international affiliate, there's a lot of communist penetration there. And he told me I was out of my mind, that I was insane for saying this. And I thought, okay, I better go and dig in this. I'm going to have to follow up Dupes by proving this one as well.
Well, there's plenty of resources out there. Last question, what's your next project?
It'll probably be a follow-up to Dupes. So, but I need to, people need to buy Dupes for me to have the incentive to follow it up. It's a very frustrating thing right now. People aren't buying books. And so you'll spend years researching all this information. You'll put it out there. I'm getting enormous publicity for the book, but it doesn't always translate into sales. And, I mean, if people aren't going to read these things, you wonder if you should even bother writing them. So I'm evaluating based on basically on how this book does. I'm finding that to get the word out there, to spread the word on what's in the book, you have to do countless op-ed pieces, countless media interviews, countless radio interviews, do Q&As, because people aren't buying books. They're watching TV and reading things off the internet. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad state.
I lied. I got one more question. What classes do you teach at Grove City College?
I'm in the political science department. I teach mainly foreign policy and 20th century history. Mm-hmm. So I do one course every spring, for example. It begins with the American Revolution and goes up through the end of the Cold War and then touches on September 11, 2001. So primarily 20th century history and foreign policy.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Richard Epstein is a prominent libertarian law professor whose books on the Constitution and how law intersects with economics have been bestsellers. In December 2011, I spoke to Professor Epstein about his book, Design for Liberty, Private Property, Public Administration, and the Rule of Law. I also asked him about the development of eminent domain policies in the wake of the Supreme Court's infamous Kelo decision of 2005.
How does this new book, Design for Liberty, differ from your previous books?
It's a little bit more philosophical. It spends much more time talking directly about public administration, which I have not talked about much in previous books. It reflects my newfound interest in public administrative law, which is usually missing from the earlier works. And, of course, it has material which I could never have covered earlier, because things like the Dodd-Frank statute and the current health care bill are all creatures of the last year or so, and therefore I never spoke about them before. It also has, I think, a fairly detailed explanation of first and second order rules, a sort of technical subject, which I didn't get to talk about today, namely, when is it that you have to resort to reasonableness rules because it turns out that hardline rules don't work. And what you have to do in order to make the rule of law work is to understand that the mere fact that there's a reasonableness in some legal system doesn't disqualify from the rule of law. But on the other hand, you can't let reasonableness determinations overwhelm the whole system. And so I try to develop a protocol as to how it is that you separate those things.
Okay. My second question is more specifically on eminent domain.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Virginia, and we're considering a constitutional amendment now in reaction to the Kelo decision.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of how states and the public have dealt with the post-Kelo environment? Are you satisfied?
No one's satisfied. I mean, the person who knows most about this is Ilya Suman, because he went through state by state. But this is the basic breakdown. There are a few states that have fairly severe changes, some of them judicial and some otherwise. Michigan and Ohio, for example, are two. Many states have cosmetic changes, which require administrators to think more deeply before they do terrible things. And some states have relatively nominal requirements. The real difference turns out not to be in the law. It turns out to be in the practice. Once the Kelo situation came down, it raised the political cost to anybody who now wants to engage in taking a private property, particularly if it turns out to be a residential home. What people have to remember is that the Midkiff case from 1984, which was written by Sandra Day O'Connor, who had her famous Kelo dissent, was hugely capacious. But it didn't raise any hackles, because what was being condemned was a non-possessory interest, a landlord's interest in property where there was a tenant that was living, and people frankly didn't care about that. These guys are landlords, they're interested in money, we give them a different stream of money. Kelo threw people off their property, and it threw them off their property for no reason at all. And you don't have to be a genius to figure out that when somebody's thrown out of their house, which is ripped down by a pitchfork, you better have a very powerful justification for doing that. And in this particular case, they said it was real estate development, which is a sort of a bad end anyhow. But worse than that, there was no real estate development that required the use of that land. So it was an exercise and a dubious end and a crazy set of means. And the two of those things together turned out to be really explosive. And so now, both on the ends chosen and the means used to achieve it, there's more scrutiny, which takes place as a sort of an automatic administrative matter.
Mm-hmm. My final question is, what's your next project after this book?
Well, I am writing a very long book now called The Classical Liberal Constitution, which is about 90% done. And what it is it takes the fundamental insights that I've developed over the years and basically gives a comprehensive analysis of every major constitutional area with a whole of a lot of compression. But it starts with basic theories of constitutional interpretation. It talks about the conflict between the progressive and the classical liberal visions. Those are things I've talked about before. It then goes through systematically the judicial, the executive, and the legislative branches, and then does all the various heads of individual rights, each getting a chapter. And unlike this book, which is slim, this one will be fat. And it will probably come out in 2012 late or in 2013. It's been a book that's been in the making for many years now. And it's an effort to give a comprehensive way in which, if you take the positions that I do, various cases and various issues have to come out. So it has some stuff on takings, but that's not the main focus on it. It has things on freedom of religion and executive power and foreign affairs and so forth. But my knowledge base is not uniform across all these areas, but what makes it possible to do this project is that the Supreme Court doctrine generally tends to be comprised in a relatively few key cases. And if you have a strong theory and you pick the right cases to read, you can write the kind of book that I'm talking about.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
Earlier this summer, the Institute for Justice, which has been described by George Will as a merry band of libertarian litigators in Washington who fight for economic rights wherever they are menaced, announced it was suing Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville in a case that has implications for taxation and the exercise of First Amendment rights to free speech and freedom of the press. I spoke to the lead attorney in the case, Renee Flaherty, and asked her to lay out the basic facts. Later, I met one of the plaintiffs who lives in Charlottesville.
We're here to talk about a case from Charlottesville in Albemarle County, Virginia. Can you lay out the facts and what's at issue in those two jurisdictions in Virginia that brought the Institutes for Justice to sue the localities.
This case is about Charlottesville and Albemarle County's business license tax. And we represent Corbin Addison and John Hart, and they are novelists there in the Charlottesville area. And they're part of a pretty large community of creative folks there in Charlottesville, writers, artists, actors, musicians. And they're there because the city really welcomes those types of people, and they've really enjoyed being there and writing there. And they've done so with no problem whatsoever for years. But recently, the city and the county hit them both with thousands of dollars in business license taxes. And that's confusing because business license taxes are meant to defray the cost of infrastructure that businesses and their customers use. But Corbin and John don't run traditional businesses. They don't have storefronts or customers. They're just writing novels, basically sitting there in their homes. And what's worse about the tax is the fact that it actually exempts the institutional press. So newspapers, magazines, radio, and television, if you work for a business like that, you're exempt from the tax. But if you're like Corbin and John working on your own, then you have to pay the tax.
And how was it discovered that they were not paying the tax and they were hit with all these thousands of dollars in back taxes all of a sudden?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we suspect that, for example, Albemarle County recently hired auditors, and they go through taxpayers' federal returns, their Schedule Cs, and look for income from businesses. And so they found at least John through that audit and identified that he's apparently subject to this business license tax.
And how did these cases come to your attention? How did the Institute for Justice get involved?
Corbin contacted us. He's actually a former lawyer. Both Corbin and John are former lawyers, and they're good friends. And Corbin saw this tax and saw that it had the exemption for the First Amendment, basically. And he thought, well, I'm a novelist. Why on earth would I not be exempt for a First Amendment exemption?
And you mentioned the First Amendment. What are the constitutional implications of this case?
The First Amendment protects everyone's right to free speech, and it doesn't discriminate based on who you are. So if you're a freelance writer, you're still protected by the First Amendment just as much as someone who works for a newspaper or a magazine.
And in the past, in the distant past at least, local governments and state governments used taxes to discourage the exercise of the First Amendment. They would tax newspapers heavily in order to make them more pliable.
That's right. There are a lot of cases, Supreme Court cases from the past, striking down targeted taxes that were aimed at the press and aimed at suppressing particular ideas. And the court, rightfully so, identified that taxes can be discouraging, and they can be used to suppress particular speech. And, you know, in this case with the business license tax, we don't necessarily think that the city or Albemarle County is aiming at suppressing any ideas, but they're unconsciously doing so by exempting some types of speakers like newspapers and magazines and not others like freelance novelists.
And this is specifically a business license tax, which suggests that they should have got a license in order to practice their writing skills.
Yes, that is fundamentally outrageous, that someone who's just sitting in their home writing a book has to ask the government for permission first, whether or not there's a tax tied to that at all. Just the fact that they have to get a license to do so is pretty outrageous, too.
Now, I suppose it's early days in the lawsuit, so the city and the county probably haven't brought a full-throated defense, but have they at all tried to justify calling being a freelance novelist a business that is subject to business taxes?
So they taxed Corbin and John under a provision that taxes all business services. And I don't know about you, but I have no idea what they mean by a business service. And they don't define it in their laws. And that's another problem with these laws, is that they're so vague that they can basically go after anyone they want. And you're right that we just filed the lawsuit recently, and so they haven't actually officially responded yet. Their responses are due August 20th, so we'll see what they say.
Now, these particular cases are with Charlottesville and Albemarle County. Do you know of other jurisdictions around the Commonwealth of Virginia or around the country that are trying to do this to freelance writers?
Well, many municipalities have business license taxes like this. For example, Arlington, where the Institute for Justice is located, does. We don't know of anywhere in Virginia that is targeting freelance writers in the same way. I know that in Los Angeles and out in California, some municipalities have done the same thing. But theoretically, any city with a business license tax could do this.
Now, would this, something like this apply to someone who works as a contractor for a business and works out of their home, you know, a teleworker who might just be doing data entry or something like that? Could they be charged a business license tax for working remotely from an office?
Theoretically, they could, because of how vague the law is. Each of the ordinances lists a number of specific occupations that are subject to the tax, but freelance writer isn't one of them. And in fact, no kind of writer is. And that's another reason why this is particularly confusing. But under that catch-all provision, that business services provision, they can sweep in any sort of teleworker or freelance worker.
So they are defining writing a novel as a business service. Who is benefiting from this service?
Well, I'm not sure. It's very confusing. It's very vague. So you would think that they would say that they're producing goods if they're producing books, but they're not. They're just saying it's a business service because that's the vaguest part of the law, and that's what they can use to sweep them in.
I'm going to have an opportunity to talk to John and Corbin before this episode goes on the air. Just from your knowledge, do they publish their novels through publishing companies, or are they self-published and sold on Amazon or something like that?
They're not self-published. They go through publishing companies.
So they're legitimate writers. They're not just some fly-by-night gamer who decided to write about fantasy. These are real serious writers.
Yes, they're both bestsellers. They sell their novels all around the country, and John has been on the New York Times bestselling list, and their books are really popular, and they've been able to sustain themselves and their families through their writing.
Maybe it's their success that brought them to the attention of the tax collectors in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, and so they are victims of their own success.
Yes, that is entirely possible.
So what's happening with the lawsuit from this point forward? Where do we go from here? Where will we be in 6 months?
So we just filed it recently, and their response is due on August 20th, and they can either answer our complaint and we move on to discovery, or they might move to dismiss the complaint. But eventually, hopefully, the case will go to trial, and Corbin and John will prevail.
Do you want to go to trial, or do you want them to give in?
I think we would be happy with any sort of victory, but the Institute for Justice loves to set precedent. That's why we litigate these cutting-edge constitutional cases, and so it's great to get that precedent.
Precedent is good because, as you say, this may apply in other jurisdictions around the country. It would be good if a solid opinion was issued in the courts here in Virginia that could be cited around the country in the future and putting down bad practices like this by tax collectors.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. I'm glad to be here at the Institute for Justice again, and I look forward to hearing from you good news on this case in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
After I left the Institute for Justice's main office in Arlington, I met with Corbin Addison, one of the two novelists who are suing Charlottesville and Albemarle County. He explained how he became involved in the case and how he and John Hart found the Institute for Justice to champion their cause.
I've been writing full-time since 2011. I practiced law here in Charlottesville before that. I went to UVA Law School, graduated in 2004, clerked for a judge here, and then stuck around. And so I've published four novels, all of which are journalistic in nature. I do a lot of research overseas and here in the U.S., and then turn it into something, at least with my past books, into a form that is a fictionalized tale about the true world, about different issues in the world, whether it's human trafficking in India, Europe, and the U.S., or gender-based violence in Africa, or the underside of the global consumer economy and corporate social responsibility. Those are the sorts of topics that I've taken on.
Later on, I'll ask you to give me the names of your novels.
Yeah, but sure.
For now, let's talk about this lawsuit. Mm-hmm. What's the nature of your complaint with the city of Charlottesville and Albemarle County, as the encompasses both jurisdictions?
Yeah, my fundamental problem with the way that they've applied the business license tax is they've done it in a discriminatory way. They have exempted specifically the institutional media. So if you're a newspaper, if you're a magazine, even if you're a newsletter publisher who publishes regularly, if you're a radio station, if you're a television station, you don't get taxed. But they have recently decided to come after freelancers. And they've done it in a way that's unusual in the sense that they've come after some of us, but not all of us. I don't frankly know exactly how they picked and choose. But they, you know, it's definitely a discriminatory application of the business license tax. If they're going to tax if they're going to tax First Amendment enterprises, they should tax all of us equally. That's my fundamental problem with it.
And how did you find out that you were being taxed when previously you had not?
So I got a letter in the mail last summer out of the blue from the Commissioner of the Revenue here in the city. So I live in the city. I file my taxes, and I note on my Schedule C, which is where you know, my CPA tells me to put all writing income. It's the business income form, you know, on Schedule C. You have to note what jurisdiction you live in. I always wondered why that was. I think it's because the locality actually gets your tax information from the state. And my understanding is that occasionally the city of Charlottesville and also Albemarle County, which applies to my friend John Hart, they will call through the Schedule C's and look for, you know, people claiming business income who aren't being taxed under the business license tax. So I think that's what happened here. They sent me a letter out of the blue. I saw a problem with it right away because I have a history both as a lawyer and also in the First Amendment. I did a lot of study in that at law school, and I was concerned about the idea of licensing a writer. And so I started looking into the law and talking to some of my friends who have First Amendment expertise, and they said, yeah, I think there's a problem here, especially once I realized that there was an exemption for the institutional media.
So you're not a plumber or a carpenter or somebody who provides services directly to the public or customers coming through your door. What kind of burdens does the city say you are placing on the infrastructure as a writer?
I raised that exact point with Todd Divers, the city commissioner, out of the gate. I said, it's hard for me to understand how I am a traditional business. I understand why you would want to tax, you know, people with, you know, say a law office or, you know, a local butcher shop or a restaurant. They've got people coming in, they're using the parking and the roads, you've got, you know, customers and clients, you're benefiting from the advertising the city does to bring people to the city and to bring potential clients and customers to you. As a writer sitting in an office or frankly sitting on an airplane or in another country, you know, putting words on a computer to then send to New York or London to be published by another company and distributed all over the world, I'm actually not, you know, I could be anywhere. I happen to live here. But it's hard for me to understand what the burden is that I'm, you know, that taxing me would defray. And the answer was silence. There was no interest in engaging that argument. The city basically said, look, the law is the law, you're covered by it, and by the way, we don't really have a concern about your First Amendment discrimination argument. We're just following what the state you know, state law says. And the state, it's the General Assembly that created the exemption for the traditional media. So the localities are just following the state.
And there's a list of businesses that can be taxed according to this law, but freelance writer is not listed among them. Is that right?
That's right. And actually, I mean, I read the code very carefully as a lawyer. I wanted to understand, do they have a claim here? Because if they do, you know, I'm not going to make an issue of it. But what I realized immediately, even before I realized there was a discrimination element, was that I wasn't officially covered. If you look at the city code, it's got an exhaustive list of over 130 different occupations that are expressly taxed. And there's no mention of any freelance creative. So there's no mention of artists, of writers, authors, painters, filmmakers, I mean, anything. You could imagine a whole realm. In fact, in this town, there are a ton of independent creatives. You could imagine a whole realm of them that the city could have taxed if they wanted to. And that raised, you know, a question for me. Did they intend to tax us, or did they actually intend to leave First Amendment enterprises out of it, especially given the express exemption for the institutional media?
Do you think that the tax notice you received might have been inadvertent because some clerk in the commissioner's office just saw a business income and they didn't look any further?
No, actually, the letter came directly from Todd Divers himself, and I wrote him back right away, and I got a letter back in the mail from him directly, and then I've spoken on the telephone with him a couple of times. You know, it's very intentional.
They know what they're doing.
They know exactly what they're doing. And they're actually, in some sense, following the county's lead. My understanding is that the county was the first to hire auditors to come after freelancers, and the Civa Weekly covered this a couple of years ago. And they came after some people who are making virtually nothing. You know, but they've also not come after people who are making a lot more, and it's not clear to me, you know, how in the world they're deciding who to tax and who not to tax. They basically are exercising an unfettered discretion in the way that they tax, which also is a constitutional problem from my perspective.
Now, you're being represented by the Institute for Justice, which is a free market-oriented public interest law firm. How did you get connected with them?
So when I realized there was a problem here, and some of my friends, my legal friends with First Amendment experience, said, yeah, I think there's an issue, I immediately knew, you know, from my experience as a lawyer, you know, when you represent yourself, you typically have a fool for a client. And so I realized that I could represent myself. I mean, I you know, litigated for years, so I know how to write a complaint. I knew what the basic arguments were, but I also recognized that it would be better for me to have coverage by somebody who was a true expert in the field. And so I knew, you know, having had exposure to a lot of different First Amendment nonprofits, that there are quite a few of them out there. Did some research on the internet and found IJ, and was delighted to see that they have a focus on the business implications, especially for small business, of constitutional law. And that's an unusual bent. Most First Amendment groups focus on individual liberties, not on businesses or on, you know, enterprise or occupations. And IJ has had an extraordinary amount of success, even in, you know, the highest courts in the land. So, and I looked at their people and I thought, you know, these guys are serious pros. I reached out to them and they were immediately interested. And especially once my friend John Hart got tagged by Albemarle County, they realized this is a, you know, multi-jurisdiction issue. It's Virginia, but it's probably nationwide. It's raising federal constitutional claims. You know, it's interesting to them, so they were happy to take it on.
Well, just to wrap it up, can you give me the names of your novels so that our listeners might be able to look them up?
Yeah, sure. So my debut back in 2012 was A Walk Across the Sun. That's the one that most people have heard of. I wrote another book called The Garden of Burning Sand, The Tears of Dark Water, and most recently A Harvest of Thorns.
We'll be looking those up. Corbin Addison, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. We'll be following this case very closely.
Thank you so much for giving us coverage.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
As it happens, a few years ago I interviewed Charlottesville Commissioner of the Revenue, Todd Divers, shortly before he was elected to that position. It's his office that sent a big tax bill to Corbin Addison. So it is interesting how, in this brief conversation, he says that the Commissioner of the Revenue's job is to treat businesses fairly and not act arbitrarily. From September 2013, here's then-candidate Todd Divers. We talked at that year's Charlottesville Pride Festival.
Todd Divers, you're running for Commissioner of Revenue, is that correct?
That's correct.
So tell me what motivated you to run for office.
I think I can do a good job at it, honestly. You know, Lee Richards has been Commissioner of Revenue for quite a while. He's a wonderful public servant. I work for a small business, and as most people who have small businesses know, you deal with the commissioner's office quite a bit. So you need someone who's sensitive to the needs of small business and who, you know, can deal with those folks because they've got a lot on their plate and they, you know, they need a lot of help. And I think I'm sensitive to their needs and to their concerns. You know, I'm not going to do any favors for anybody, but, you know, I think it's important to have someone with that kind of a perspective.
Now, this is the first time in nearly 45 years that the commissioner's race is contested.
Yes.
Does that make any difference in the way you're approaching voters?
Not really. You know, I mean, it's about competence and trying to convince folks that I'm competent to do the job, and I think I am. And you know, I don't think it really matters. Lee's got a lot of faith in me, which means a lot. I respect the heck out of the guy, and you know, I hope people listen to him.
Now, when somebody comes to the voting booth, a lot of voters are going to look at that and say, "Commissioner of Revenue, what is that?" So, tell me, what does the Commissioner of Revenue do?
Primarily assesses business taxes. It determines the value of property, personal property, different kinds of business property, so that people know what kind of taxes they owe on it. We don't actually collect the taxes. We determine the value and, you know, what the assessment is, and the Treasurer's Office collects the taxes.
What is your relationship with the Treasurer's Office? Is it just two people on opposite sides of the corridor, or do you actually have real interaction?
You're going to have real interaction, and it's not always going to be perfectly harmonious, you know, but I think everybody's professionals, and we all are working in the interest of the city, so I think it generally works out pretty well.
Okay, well, I think that answers my question, so I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no, man. Thanks for stopping by.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the editors and writers at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to return next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to offer comments and suggestions on our website at beringdrift.com. We'll be looking for you.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.